This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
A way out could be just to modify the old 1951 constitution and implement it as an interim solution.
That's Libya analyst Wolfgang Borstei discussing options for elections in the country. Details coming up also. Botswana has emerged among Africa's most vaccinated nation. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The Speaker of the Libyan Parliament, Akila Saleh, called for forming a new transitional government and a 30-member committee to draft the consensus constitution before holding the postponed elections. But the UN Secretary-General's advisor on Libya, Stephanie Williams, said that Libya does not need a new transitional government after having five over the past several years. She said what Libya needs now are democratically elected institutions. Wolfgang Borstei, former military attaché in Libya, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the complicated situation in Libya.
A continuation of the Dabeiba government would certainly make the situation, which is already complicated, even more difficult. According to the Libya Political Dialogue Forum roadmap, which was endorsed by a UN Security Council resolution and an HOR vote of non-confidence last September, the mandate of Dabeiba's GNU expired on 24 December. Dabeiba has quite some support among the young people, especially in Tripolitania, because of his money gifts to them. So if the HOR really appoints a new prime minister, it needs to be seen if Dabeiba will hand over power. Any new prime minister would need the support of the mighty Misrata militia to be able to assume the office, or they would need to temporarily relocate the government to another city, for example, to Sirte. But this could easily mean that Libya has again two governments. A new prime minister would also need the support of the key economic institutions, the National Oil Corporation and the Central Bank of Libya, whose chairs are currently strongly backing Dabeiba. Regarding the constitution, the current draft constitution has no realistic chance to be accepted throughout Libya. A 50+1 majority in each of the three provinces would be required. And this probably motivated Saleh to discuss the drafting of a new constitution. But this would certainly take more than 6 months, probably more than 1 year. Last time they needed 3 years. So this would also ensure, which is maybe also in the intention of Saleh, that there are no elections anytime soon. A way out could be just to modify the old 1951 constitution and implement it as an interim solution, as it was not only proposed by me since 2014, but also right now by an increasing number of influential Libyan personalities.
UN Secretary General's advisor on Libya, Stephanie Williams, said that Libya does not need a new transitional government after having five ones over the last years. Could Williams mobilize international support for holding the elections by June this year?
As the failed attempt to have elections on 24 December last year clearly demonstrates, international support is not enough to ensure elections in Libya. Now it will be even more difficult, as the United Nations, the US and the Europeans have lost quite a lot of credibility in Libya. I would say elections can't be imposed in Libya from the outside. The Williams statement that Libya does not need a new transitional government was strongly rejected by several HOR members, as this would mean Dabeiba should stay on as a prime minister, which is unacceptable for many, including to most of the presidential candidates. I agree with Williams that Libya needs democratically elected institutions, but I doubt that maintaining the current government would do any good to the country and speed up the process. Personalities like ex-Minister of the Interior Fatih Bashagha or ex-Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Maidig, both from Misrata, or Arif Ali Al-Nayed, a moderate Sufi Islamic scholar, could be a good solution to govern Libya in another interim period.
Williams said that she traveled from east to west of Libya, talking to Libyans, and found various views. Some said that a constitutional basis is needed for the elections to continue. Others wanted the draft constitution to be put to a referendum, while another group wanted the list of presidential candidates be subjected to some form of judicial oversight in order to open the blockage and go directly to the elections. Can Libyans reach a compromise on that one?
To be honest, and I hope I'm wrong, I fear this is not realistic for several reasons. Over most of its history, Libya never ever had been a unified state. There are deep rifts since centuries between the three historic provinces, and they were deepened by years of a cruel civil war. The vast majority of Libya's oil is not found in Tripolitania, but most of the money is spent there, and the country is governed from there in a centralized way. How long can this work? I don't expect that the people in the east and in the south will accept this situation in the long run. So one way out could be a formula for the distribution of the oil revenues, so that everyone has its just share of the wealth of the country. I would say Libya should remain as a country, but as a federation of free provinces, any kind of centralized state is about to fail. The best way forward would be to have presidential and parliamentary elections very soon to get rid of the current corrupt political class, not only of the Dabeiba government. The return thereafter to the 51 constitution could be decided by the parliament for a temporary basis. This could be used as a tool to stabilize Libya in its parts. It's not realistic to stabilize Libya in a centralized way. I'm not sure how Libya will look like next year, but I'm sure in 10 years, Libya will be either such a federation or it will be broken up after a long and very bloody civil war.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shenawi. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, authorities say they have arrested the suspects in the murder of the Italian ambassador to the country last year. Ambassador Luca Attanasio, his bodyguard Vittorio Lacavacci, and their driver Mustafa Milambo were killed in February 2021 on the way to visit a United Nations humanitarian project. Reporter Jafar Al-Kitanti is in Goma in the Eastern DRC, and he spoke with my VOA editor Kate Pound-Dawson about the arrests.
The general of the North Kivu police presented to the North Kivu governor in the afternoon a group of alleged assassins who operate in the Eastern DRC based in Goma, and in that group, two of them was the ones who killed the Italian ambassador Luca Attanasio.
Did they say why they think these men killed the ambassador?
Two of them claimed to do it, accepted they are the one who did it, because one of them was captured on January 8th this year, and after an interrogation with intelligence service, he gave all details, and from him, two others was captured. And one of them, their chief, is missing till now, but they are looking for him. And he said the Mr. Bahati, who was the chief of the team captured, said the deal was not to kill him, it just was a kidnapping and then ask for money. But when the park rangers attacked them and they start shooting, one of them, the guy called Aspirant, who is not captured yet, killed the ambassador, and it was a lose of money, because they could not get money if the ambassador was killed.
In other words, they were looking only for money, and they see this attempt as a loss of money that they failed in their efforts. Have they done similar kidnappings?
Yes, they claim to be the ones who kidnapped the ICRC guy and the last NGO guys from CONCERN, and they are the ones who attacked the UNHCR convoy in different areas. So it's a big group of many guys, but since police took some of them, many of them left the province.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Kitanti in Goma. He was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Intermittent but heavy rains have been battering parts of South Africa for weeks, causing flooding, drownings, and damage estimated at hundreds of millions of rands. Just a few years ago, the country was enduring one of its worst ever droughts. At the time, meteorologists and weather scientists predicted that the five-year dry spell would likely be followed by 5 years of water abundance. As Darren Taylor reports, they ascribe the cycle to climate change.
Across South Africa, water departments are opening sluice gates of major reservoirs to let water out as deluges threaten to break dam walls. Towns and villages downstream, already battling floods of their own, are being flooded further. The situation's particularly bad in parts of KwaZulu-Natal province, where Chris Pappas is mayor of Umgeni municipality. He says the area's been hit by bad weather since 30 December.
There was an incredibly massive, a freak storm that came out of nowhere. And not only did it have heavy rains, but it also had heavy winds. So we had incredible volume and velocity of water, but an also incredible amount of wind. Since then, it's been an unusually high rainfall for this particular summer period. And we have not had an opportunity to recover and recuperate. It continuously rains every afternoon here, and not just, you know, a little bit, but a lot.
Because of climate change, say some scientists, rains now falling in southern African regions that in the past received rain only in winter. That means many areas are unprepared for flooding. Farmers' crops are ruined, with thousands of people forced to shelter on higher ground without food, medicine, and other essentials. Papa says the water won't stop streaming into Umgeni.
That's led to widespread infrastructure damage. And, you know, a municipality of our size is, we don't plan for a disaster that covers from, you know, wall to wall of the municipality. And you've heard 272 million rand. That is half our annual budget. And we're going to need assistance to try and recover from that.
The mayor points out that the 272 million rands damage is only to municipal property, such as roads and traffic lights.
There's other damage that's occurred to people's homes and informal settlements as well. So poorly built houses or houses that were built in wetlands or with material that they shouldn't have been built with. I think the hardest hit of those are people in informal settlements, but also those living in rural areas who are still living in mud houses, unfortunately. Rain and mud don't go well together, and you have people...
Pappas, who's a member of opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, says much of the infrastructure is aging and was poorly maintained for many years.
What we've inherited is an infrastructure that has either been poorly created, so it's been constructed out of poor materials or people who don't know what they're doing, or we've inherited infrastructure that has been under-maintained for so many years and has now passed its lifespan.
He says a lesson to local governments is to keep what they have in good condition, rather than spending on fancy town halls and luxury vehicles for officials.
As municipalities, we spend a lot of money on the nice-to-haves, the things that look good during elections. You know, you can say, here's my hall, or here's something that I've built. But if you actually don't invest in the stuff that you have already, you're going to have huge issues such as what we have now. Let us fix what we have across all communities before we can start thinking of new things, because we're just compounding our problems when we add to our asset registers and we're unable to maintain what we have.
The government's declared some flooded districts, including Umgeni, disaster areas. It says humanitarian aid programs are beginning and money will be added to budgets to start emergency rebuilds. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A South African study has found the Omicron variant of COVID-19 is less severe than previous ones. Even for the unvaccinated, the country's top scientists say this could be good news for bringing an end to the pandemic, as the highly contagious variant also spreads resistance. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
South Africans no longer have to race to get home before midnight. A curfew imposed at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic was finally scrapped ahead of New Year's Eve. Now, Dr. Marianne Davies, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Cape Town, says there's more good news about the latest coronavirus variant, Omicron.
We see about a 25% lowering of the risk of death, so about 1.3 times lower risk of death. And so that makes us think that residual effect, that 25% reduction, could be the true effect due to lower virulence of the Omicron compared to previous variants.
So that reduction is compared to the previous Delta variant, which was more severe than the original virus. The study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, found Omicron to be similar in severity to the first wave. Davey says a major difference now is that prior infections and vaccinations help reduce hospitalizations and deaths. While Omicron evaded vaccines and reinfected people, Dr. Shabir Madi, a professor of vaccinology at the University of the Witwatersrand, says that's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's going to boost immune responses in people that were previously infected. It's going to boost immune responses in people that have been vaccinated. And it will also result in further immunity in people that haven't been previously infected or vaccinated up until now. The data is quite compelling. That people that have this hybrid immunity, vaccine together with infection, in fact, they probably got a better immune response.
Scientists emphasize getting the virus is no substitute for a vaccine. Death rates remain highest among people who aren't inoculated. Official government figures say over 93,000 lives have been lost. Davies says getting sick has other consequences.
But even a mild variant can cause a lot of chaos for a health service, for a number of reasons. The one is with these very high transmission rates, you get a lot of people infected at any one time, and that includes healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. And so that means that you've got a lot of people who are off work and often their contacts needing to be quarantined, and that can have huge impacts.
Still, the promise of less stringent protocols is welcome to businesses hurting from nearly 2 years of curfews and lockdowns. Alex Zabo is the owner of the Antisocial Club, a bar and restaurant in Johannesburg.
There was a big conversational point on the 28th of December, where do we stay closed or do we reopen? And the reason we reopened was these extra 3 hours. We do believe that there has to be a brighter day coming.
Whether increased immunity amid fewer restrictions will be enough to ward off the worst effects of the coronavirus will be tested by future variants. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
While the majority of African countries struggle to vaccinate their populations against COVID-19, Botswana has emerged among the continent's most vaccinated nations and has already begun offering booster shots. From Habrone, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
According to the World Health Organization, only 7 African countries, including Botswana, managed to vaccinate at least 40% of their populations by December 2021. The WHO warns many African countries will miss the June target of vaccinating at least 70% of their population against COVID-19. However, Botswana does not face such problems, with at least 70.6% of the country's eligible population fully vaccinated. The Southern African country, with a population of 2.4 million, has started administering booster doses and also vaccinating children between 12 and 17. In December, Minister of Health Edwin Dikolodi indicated Botswana was one of the most vaccinated countries in the world.
Our vaccination progress has surpassed many countries in Africa and placed us at par with some in the developed world. We did not only surpass our own target of 64% of the targeted population, which we were to reach by end of December 2021, but we have also exceeded the target set by the WHO for countries to have vaccinated at least 40% of their population by end of December 2021.
This week, the country's task force deputy coordinator Musipili Musipili said thanks to the successful vaccination program, the effect of Omicron has not been severe.
With relation to our efforts at vaccinating persons in Botswana, again, I'm relating to this to where we stood as of the 29th of November, the beginning of the Omicron wave. We had almost about 500,000 fully vaccinated. As of the 13th of January, now we have 1,065,097 fully vaccinated. We believe that part of the reason why we are not experiencing as many COVID-19 related deaths is because of this high vaccination rate.
Mosipili says at least 45,000 people in Botswana have contracted the Omicron variant, while 115 fatalities were recorded since the variant was found in the country.
Fortunately, we continue to register COVID-19 related deaths. As of the 13th, the total number of COVID-19 associated fatalities stands at 2,534. And again, in the period between the 29th of November 2021, when we really started to experience widespread transmission of Omicron, we recorded a total of 115 COVID-19 fatalities. This number is a lot lower than the numbers we observed during the Delta wave.
After a slow start, the Botswana government entered supply agreements with leading manufacturers for the supply of vaccines. In December alone, Botswana received more than 1 million doses. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Hauroni, Botswana.
Authorities in Cameroon are blaming Anglophone separatists for the abduction of 8 rubber plantation workers Friday in the country's volatile southwest region. The country's agricultural workers trade union is pleading for the workers' safe release. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé.
Yeah, today, now the 15th of January 2022, we there for here with the workers and for CDC, where they will be arrested by the restoration forces.
A man speaks in Pidgin English as he presents 8 men and women as enemies of separatist groups fighting to carve out an independent English-speaking state in Western Cameroon. In the audio extracted from a video widely circulated on social media, the man says fighters abducted the civilians for collaborating with Cameroonian government troops. The video also appears to show the men and women holding rifles. The speaker in the video says separatists expect the civilians to use the rifles to fight the government. The civilians are also forced to sing a song the speaker in the video calls the national anthem of Ambazonia. Ambazonia is the name of the state separatists say they are fighting to create. Cameroon's military says people seen in the video are rubber plantation workers abducted Friday from the town of Tiku. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of the southwest region where Tiko is located, says the 8 abductees are employees of the Cameroon Development Corporation. Gabriel Bene Vefonge, president of Cameroon Agriculture and Allied Workers Trade Union, called for the workers' release.
We are appealing to whosoever group of persons that is keeping these workers to kindly release them. Workers have nothing to do with the armed conflict. They should leave workers alone.
Speaking over a messaging app from Tiku, Vefonge said a breastfeeding mother is among the abducted workers. Adamu Chinda, who works at the Tiko rubber plantation, says workers took the woman's 3-month-old daughter to the Tiko hospital Monday.
I'm going there now to see how we can raise some money and buy the essential things that they need. Let them even release that breastfeeding mother so that she can take care of the child and the child be dying because of lack of care.
This is not the first time Cameroon Development Corporation workers have been attacked. In 2020, officials of the agro-industrial complex said that more than 6,000 of its 20,000 workers had fled attacks, killings, and kidnappings. Cameroon's separatist conflict began in 2016 after teachers and lawyers in the north and southwest regions, where English is the predominant language, protested alleged discrimination from the country's French-speaking majority. The conflict has killed an estimated 4,000 people and displaced more than 750,000. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A stunning upset at the Africa Cup of Nations tournament yesterday when four-time champion Ghana was sent packing by Tani Comoros. Just 2 days after Equatorial Guinea shook up the tournament by beating defending champion Algeria, Comoros yesterday humiliated Ghana with a 3-2 win in the Group C clash. By defeating Ghana, Comoros, making its debut cup appearance, might even sneak into the last 16 as one of the best third-placed finishers. Also yesterday, Morocco won the group after twice coming from behind to draw 2-2 against Gabon, which had 8 players out with COVID-19 infections. In Group B, Senegal finished on top while Guinea came in second. In Group D matches today, Nigeria faces Guinea-Bissau, while Egypt will be looking for a much-improved performance against Sudan to take second place. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhid in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com.